On this edition of Josh Nason's Punch-Out, learn all about Shamrock, the World's Most Dangerous Man, a book coming to you, hopefully, in August 2019 by author Jonathan Stonen, he of MMA Encyclopedia, Total MMA and Shooters, and, of course, Bleacher Report. So we talk about the book, we talk about the current MMA media scene, we talk about the current state of MMA, and all that good stuff as well. Even some Stan Lee as well. So stick around for that and more on Josh Nason's Punch-Out, coming up like right now. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Josh Nason's Punch-Out here on WrestlingObserver.com. I'm Josh Nason, of course, writer, editor, podcaster, best friend, dad, husband, all that good stuff. How's everyone doing? Hopefully good. It is coming up on Thanksgiving. Not this week, but the week after. I was alerted to that by my calendar. Holy shit. This month is like flying by, absolutely flying by. But enough about date and weather talk and all the good stuff. I want to get into a very entertaining show featuring someone I've wanted to have on the show for quite some time, and I was just picking the right time to do it. Didn't want to talk about, you know, a UFC Poughkeepsie or something like that. I wanted to kind of get in some good substance, and we found a good topic to talk about because he's got a book to sell. Jonathan Stonen. He is a author of several MMA books. Total MMA, MMA Encyclopedia, Shooters. He writes for Bleacher Report now, River Bloody Elbow, and some other sites in the past. He has got a book that he's working on about Ken Shamrock entitled Shamrock, the World's Shamrock, the World's Most Dangerous Man. There you go, which you can actually fund and help out on Indiegogo right now. If you go to Jonathan's Twitter account, you will see a link pinned at the top, and it is got about 19 days left in this, trying to raise $10,000 to help back the effort. And it sounds like a really interesting book. And the reason I know this is because I just talked to Jonathan for this podcast. In this podcast, it's a little bit longer than usual, but it's really good. I will tell you that. We jump all around. We kind of start off talking about comics and Stan Lee, of all things. And then we go talking to MMA media. We talk about how he wrote some of his different books and kind of how he got this start there. We talk about the MMA media. We talk about the MMA in general today. John's been following the sport for more than 10 years, his interest in pro wrestling and all these type of things. And eventually we wind our way around to the book itself and how the project came together. And really just kind of the behind the scenes of how this thing is happening and the process and all this stuff. And obviously his first go at funding a book like this, which I thought was really fascinating as well. So we jump around the map a little bit, but this was this is one of my favorite ones I've done in quite some time. And it was, I was glad to have Jonathan on. He's someone that I've known for quite some time. Haven't talked in, actually talked in a long time. We were working on a site called, project called MMA Madness, which is a website that was, I think someone else has it now. But a site like he was on it, Spencer Kite was on it. I think Jeremy Botter was doing some stuff with it. And there was a few of us together, kind of this super team, so to speak, to put this site together. The late Brian Levick was working on it. And at the end, it was basically just Spencer, Brian, and Levick and I doing it. And it just faltered. It just was supposed to be a money winner, but you know, it just didn't work. 3 months, 4 months, 5 months later, something like that, the site went away. But anyway, so Jonathan and I, we talked for about an hour about all types of stuff, but we hadn't actually talked since then, so it's good to catch up, and I think you guys will enjoy this conversation a lot. So sit back, relax, enjoy this hour-long conversation about, really, the life and times of Jonathan Stonen. Enjoy. Well, since I started this podcast 3 years ago, I had kind of an idea of my first kind of round of guests that I wanted to have. And more than 3 years later, I'm embarrassed to say I finally got one of those guests. It should have been a lot sooner than that, but I was glad to finally get him tonight, and for good reason. And part of that is because I want to have a nice kind of juicy topic to talk about. And what better than trying to crowdsource and fund a great book that everyone's going to check out? So we're here tonight. So join me on the line is the senior writer for Bleacher Report, and he is an author of several outstanding books, two of which I'm staring at right now across from me. Total MMA and the MMA Encyclopedia, also another great book, Shooters as well. And he is putting together another book about Ken Shamrock entitled Shamrock, the World's Most Dangerous Man. We're going to talk to him about that and all kinds of other stuff tonight. Jonathan Snowden joins us tonight. And John, we'll start with the really tough questions first. And actually, something I think that you'll want to talk about is the passing of Stan Lee. And I know you're a big, if I remember right, in knowing from Twitter and other conversations, that you are a fan of comics or graphic novels, or kind of the art. What did you think when you heard about the passing of Stan Lee this week?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it's hard to say surprising, because I think Stan was what, 95 years old or something like that. So, I guess you can't say it was surprising, but it still hits you pretty hard, especially when you're somebody like me who grew up as one of these kids that would go every week to the comic book store. My store was called Southern Comics, and it was in the shopping center with a Kroger grocery store in Irmo, South Carolina. So comics were huge for me. It was like it's just what I did. Other kids played video games, and I did too. But my main thing when I got my allowance, I spent pretty much every penny at the comic book store. And of course, a big part of that was Stan Lee. And you don't need me to tell you how great Stan was and the comics that he created and the world basically he created for Marvel Comics. I mean, it's going to live forever, I think. So, what a titan and what a loss for anybody who loves comic books and now anybody who loves movies. Stan has probably touched everybody who's listening to this, whether they've ever read a comic book or not, they've been influenced by the art he created, and that's pretty powerful.
So I think you and I might be around the same age. I'm 40. I'm not sure how old you are, but I think we're around the same age, right?
Yeah, I'm a couple years older than you, but we are contemporaries.
Okay, so I think when you mentioned getting comics when you were a lot younger, I was the same way. Do you remember spinner racks? The racks of
of course, yeah. So by the time you got a little bit older, though, like that's how what is the Mallrats? Do they say that that's how with savages take care of their comic books, putting them in spinner racks and stuff? If you're a sophisticated collector of children's comic books, you put them in a bag with like a board behind them to protect them, and then a little bit later on, you learn that that's not enough, and those materials have to be acid so you learn a lot, and you learn a lot of hard lessons as a comic book reader, especially if later on you want to try to sell some of those comics. That spinner rack is no good, but that was definitely where you would get your comics, like if you went to the grocery store or something like that. So that's usually people's first introduction to comics was in that mechanism. And then you would have to just like search, because it wouldn't just be all the same comic behind the front one. You'd have to search for the best ones. And I don't know. Comics were fun. And the spinner rack was a good deal when you were a kid.
I remember the excitement of flipping through and finding something that you didn't really realize you were looking for, but then all of a sudden you found it. You're like, oh, wow. And it was just kind of like buried like in the back. And these spinner racks have like, five or six books per rack, depending on how packed in they were. And you're able to find something. You're like, oh, my God, I finally found this. And I just remember that thrill the thrill of the hunt, I guess you could say, in trying to find something that you really wanted. So, yeah, I was Laverdier's was a drugstore chain. That was my drug of choice, so to speak, when it came to doing that, before I found my local comic book store, too.
Well, that is awesome. And it was a different world, too, because, you didn't have the internet and stuff like that. And so, you kind of just had to take your chances sometimes, and the cover would play a big part of it. And it could really influence you a lot in the choices you made. Because, if you're like me, usually your mom is, she's just not giving you a lot of time to sit and stare at those comics. Like you got like a 30 seconds, 45 seconds to make your decision on the way to the register. And so, I bought a lot of bad comics with flashy covers, probably.
Were you into wrestling magazines growing up?
Oh, I mean, of course. Yeah. Are you kidding me? The bloodier, the better.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was just thinking, like, I kind of, my head, I like pan over to the right and I see the magazine rack and flipping through and find like Pro Wrestling Illustrated and, you know, oh my God, now I'm blanking on some Inside Wrestling, you know, so just the After mags and then some of the, you know, the non-After mags and things like that. So yeah, it was the
non-After ones that would have like the more gruesome photographs, and they would have like these, you know, the quality of the actual magazine was much lower, and the paper they used would just fall apart and turn colors and stuff. But on the cover of them, they would always have like Dusty Rhodes covered in blood or Jimmy Valiant or somebody. And like that was where you learned about the dark side of wrestling. And it was cool, 'cause we used to go to the store that had all the magazines, and the wrestling stuff would be back near the porn. So you like, as a kid, you didn't know which to look at, to sneak a look at more, the bloody wrestling covers or the pornography. So that was a good corner to be in.
So for those that don't know, and at this point, if you're listening to the show, I can't imagine you wouldn't know this, but Jonathan writes about the pro wrestling very well, obviously, MMA very well, obviously, and boxing too. When did, what was your gateway into this combat sports world? Was it wrestling? And if so, when did it start and how did it start?
Yeah. So, I think boxing and wrestling probably around the same time, you know, like when we were kids, boxing was still like a staple of regular television. So like on Saturdays and stuff, ABC and CBS would often have free boxing cards with some of the best boxers in the world. And so that's kind of how I started watching boxing, with people like Sugar Ray Leonard and people like that. And wrestling too was huge. Like once it hit me, I remember, I think I was in the fifth grade when I really got into wrestling. And it's just like kind of how like kids get into something. Like the kids at school were talking about it, and I grew up in the South, so it was the National Wrestling Alliance was the big thing, and Superstation WTBS was where it was at. And so, you know, that was right in the era of the Four Horsemen and Dusty Rhodes and my favorite, the Rock and Roll Express. And my what really got me into it, I think, was one summer at summer camp. There was a kid there named Chris Cooper. I remember his name. He was really into wrestling, and there was always a skit. So you did a skit at the end of summer camp, and ours was wrestling, and we did a wrestling match. Was the Rock and Roll Express against the Midnight Express, and because I wore glasses, though, I had to be Jim Cornette, and I wanted to be Ricky Morton so bad, but I was Jim Cornette, and that was kind of like the first time I realized that maybe I wasn't going to be like, I'm not the star, I'm not the hero, I'm Jim Cornette. But I definitely remember not knowing exactly how wrestling was worked. I definitely potatoed that kid with a tennis racket, like legit. So I guess Jim Cornette had the last laugh. But that was really how I got into wrestling, was just watching it on television and then going to watch matches sometimes at the township in Columbia, South Carolina. And then, you know, the cool thing about it is through the wrestling magazines you were talking about, you would kind of discover these other characters. And it was very much like comic books, where like, you know, you may read the X-Men and you've heard about the Avengers, but you don't really know that much about them. And maybe you'll see the covers and stuff. And wrestling was the same way. And then we would go and visit like my grandparents or, you know, one of my uncles in Oklahoma. And instead of the wrestlers I was used to, all of a sudden we're seeing the Von Erichs and stuff like that. And so I really discovered, through the fact that my family lived all over the country, I discovered a lot of wrestling. So I was big into it as a kid.
I remember when we where I grew up, we didn't have cable. So eventually we got one of those big like C-band satellite dishes, like one of the huge ones.
Right.
After like, you know, years and years and years of just having the three channels. And the only thing I got was Superstars of Wrestling on Saturday afternoons. And you would have to like try to angle the antenna and the foil right, you know, just to, you know, make sure everything came in. And I remember just, you know, flipping around one night and finding USWA, and it was America One, which is this random, like, quote unquote network. And they would run wrestling like almost every night from like 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. and sometimes 2. And it would be like USWA, ECW they ran, and something else too. But I remember that when you first, you know, you go and you kind of like your world gets expanded. This is way before the internet. your world gets expanded. Like, oh wow, they're doing this wrestling in other places, and this is stuff I've always read about. And it was, you mentioned about, you know, comics and how different things are today, even just with media in general. Just that time, man, it was just when you were able to discover something new like that and not just find something on your phone or via Google search, something like that, it blew your mind, right? And now I wonder, like, for my kids and your kids and every, like, everyone else, like, it's going to be hard to explain exactly what that sensation was like.
Yeah, like how excited you were to find. For me, it was like when the video store, because we used to rent wrestling on VHS tapes. And, you know, so it would be so exciting when they got a new event in, because I could finally stop like renting Starrcade 1986, the Skywalkers, you know, the Night of the Skywalkers. You know, I'd probably rented that like 20 times. And then finally they'd get something new in, like Great American Bash 1987. And you'd be like, oh, we're going to rent that bunch of times. So yeah, you discover it like it just kind of trickles into your life back in those days. Now, of course, today, if you got into wrestling, there would almost immediately be, you'd have access to like every wrestling match you'd ever want to watch. And that's pretty cool in some ways. And then in others, it does kind of cheat you out of that opportunity to really yearn for it. And that's what kind of like drives that passion, I think, is the fact that it's not easy. Sometimes, you know, it creates this kind of mania to acquire it and to see it and to learn about it. And that's kind of the era that you and I grew up in. Even much later, where, you know, I'm trading for tapes and I've got boxes of hundreds, thousands, probably wrestling tapes and MMA tapes from Japan and other places. Like, it really kind of took a hold of my life in some ways, as sad as that sounds, I guess, when you say it out loud.
You and I have written for a couple different websites before. You helped me get my gig at Bloody Elbow many years ago. And we were talking before the call about the long deceased MMA Madness site, and that project came together. But I don't think I've ever known how you got your start writing. How did that begin?
I was the editor of my student newspaper when I was in college as an undergrad. And so, you know, I've kind of always had an interest in telling stories and learning about people, and nothing really better than journalism if you're interested in all access pass to anywhere you want to go and anything you want to learn about. You know, if you're a reporter or a writer, people welcome you in. And so I've been kind of adjacent to this business for a long time. I got out of it, though. You know, I didn't pursue it as a professional career. And I just kind of, you know, I was big into the message board scene and the news group scene as a wrestling and MMA guy. I was really just a fan, writing about stuff on the internet just for fun. And, you know, eventually MMA caught the interest of kind of like the broader populace with the advent of the Ultimate Fighter and stuff like that. All of a sudden there's like professional writers attempting to tell these stories of MMA fighters and of MMA. And I'm not going to name any names, but almost every one of them was getting it entirely wrong, right? They didn't have the breadth of knowledge they needed to really write about MMA, which is kind of a complicated subject. And so, long story somewhat short, I just decided, like, why can't I do it? You know, if these guys can do it and they don't know anything about it, why not me? And so we started a blog, and my friends and I, and some of them became, you know, fairly prominent, like Dave Walsh, who ran Headkick Legend and is one of the foremost experts in the world on kickboxing and guys like that. David Bixenspan from Deadspin and people like that. You know, we kind of got together and formed a blog. And almost immediately after that, I just out of nowhere just kind of decided, you know, there's no real history of mixed martial arts that you can read about. I had gone overseas with the Army and been gone for a year and come back right as the Ultimate Fighter was starting off. And I wanted to know, like, how did we go from when I left, we were trading fourth generation tapes of UFC and no one could get it on cable, to now it's like, it's a cable show. Like, you know, it's, yeah, everyone can watch it. Like, how did we get from here to, from there to here? And there was no real answer for me. And it just occurred to me, like, there needs to be a book about MMA. And almost out of, you know, I don't know what kind of hubris, like what possessed me to think I would be qualified, but I wrote a letter to ECW Press and said, hey, you guys need to have a book about the history of MMA, and here's why I'm the guy to write it. And they wrote me back and said yes. And all of a sudden, I was writing a book, and that's how Total MMA came to be. And so really the first major thing I ever did, the first paid assignment I ever had, was a book about the history of MMA, which is kind of crazy when you think about it.
Yeah. So what during the experience of writing that first book, what did you think, what were your assumptions going into it, and what were the realities coming out of it?
About like what the process would be like?
Yeah.
I'd like to say it was harder than I thought, but it really, it was surprisingly easy. I look at it now and kind of cringe at a lot of the writing. You know, I wasn't really well experienced, and I had never written anything. You know, in law school, I'd written a paper that was 35 pages or something maybe. But, you know, I'd never written anything nearly with this kind of breadth and demanding this level of research. So in that way, it was kind of hard. But, you know, I expected it to be harder to get in touch with the people in the industry. And at that time, it really wasn't. Like, you know, somebody like me with no track record and no background and no known associates, you know, I didn't know a bunch of fighters. I didn't have any ins. And you know, I'm getting on the phone with, you know, Ken Shamrock and Randy Couture, and I'm talking to the founders of the UFC, like Kamel McLaren and David Isaacs and Bob Myrowitz. All these people are willing to talk to me. And you're like, you know, it's kind of wild that it happened that way. You know, I talked to Boss Rutten and for about Pancras and Guy Metzger, and, you know, people were just picking up the phone, and it would just start with, like, you know, I remember my first ever interview for the book was with Jason DeLucia, who was a Lion's Den fighter who had fought in UFC and then fought in Pancras. And, like, you know, it went fairly well, I guess. And then so, like, he gave me Vernon White's phone number, and I got Frank Shamrock's phone number, and then eventually worked my way up to Ken. And, it, like, you know, it just kind of flowed that way. So it was – no one could ever do that today. Like, can you imagine – like somebody coming off the street and trying to be like, oh, I'm going to call up Brock Lesnar. You know, it just doesn't work. I can't call up Brock Lesnar, and I've been doing this for 10 years. So it's definitely a different world. So I think I came in at just the right time to make that book possible, you know, just the right time where it wasn't big enough that someone better than me and more experienced than me was interested. Cause there wasn't there wasn't a lot of money in it, but you know, it wasn't quite big enough that you couldn't just jump in. So it was really perfect timing for me.
Yeah. The one thing one of the things that I really liked about the book was the time in my life when it came out was I jumped aboard the UFC train in 2005 when the Ultimate Fighter was running after Raw. I think that was a lot of fans came on board, and I was just like, oh, wow, this is really interesting. And yeah, I'd obviously known about Liddell and Ortiz and played the UFC video game back in the day, but I didn't really know much other than that. Just didn't really grab my interest like wrestling or even boxing did at the time. And that, you know, everyone knows what Ultimate Fighter did for the sport and what have you. But, you know, once you kind of get on board with that and start watching shows, you're kind of on the train, right? And you're just like, the train's going and you're in the current, but there's also this, you're kind of looking back like, how did we get to this point? So at the point the book came out, it was really valuable for me, because I was super into MMA, but I didn't really understand a lot of the history of it, and like how do I get the history of it in one comprehensive spot? And your book was a great resource for me and for a lot of other people for that, and it even continues to be. I think if someone gets into the sport now and is trying to understand really how did it begin way back when, you know, I would reference your book first. So great job with that.
Well, I appreciate it. And you were exactly the audience I was aiming for, partially because, you know, like I was saying, for some things I was in there, I was the audience, you know, I taught myself some of MMA history by writing the book. And of course, like other things I'd picked up as a fan, but I definitely, there was a need for it. And if it wasn't me, it would have been somebody else. But I guess selfishly, I'm glad it was me.
Me as well. And then the MMA Encyclopedia, it is essentially, I would call it a companion book, right? Because it kind of just, if someone really wants to know the names and understand a lot more of the history, they can pick up the encyclopedia. Kind of explain how that came to be and how you kind of see the two. Do you see the two pairing together like that?
Yeah, I definitely think it was really important to me that it not just like repurpose the stuff from Total MMA and just kind of copy and paste it underneath like the name of an athlete or a promotion and voila, a new book. You know, my writing partner and I, Kendall Shields, really wanted to create something new and it allowed us to go into like a little bit more. I mean, there's still encyclopedia entries, so they're fairly brief, but at the same time, it allowed us to talk about promotions and techniques and ideas and fighters that, you know, maybe didn't really warrant a place in the grand history of mixed martial arts, but definitely were worth people knowing about and worth their story being told. And so we were able to include a lot of those in the book. Not nearly enough. Like, no, I look back at it and I'm really kind of embarrassed, like the short shrift that we gave to women's MMA. I think that there's maybe two women in the entire book, Gina Carano and Chris Cyborg. And, you know, we really cheated some of the women who were foundational figures in mixed martial arts. And, so that's a room for somebody else to come in and fix some of our errors. But other than that, yeah, I definitely see it as not a replacement for Total MMA and not really just like a redux or like a reboot, but really something different and distinct. And so it didn't do nearly as well commercially, but I think it's something that we can be proud of for sure. Mm.
So you mentioned you've been doing the Rang Game for at least 10 years, involved obviously the books and Bloody Elbow and obviously Bleacher Report and other projects as well. One of the things that I admire about you a lot is you're very honest. And I think that's great because I think in media we have a lot of not honest people, you know. I think that's pretty fair to say. And I was curious kind of your take as far as the MMA media goes as a whole, because you've been obviously very, I want to say outspoken, but I think very truthful as far as, you know, when certain things come up and issues come up. How have you seen things change since you started almost 10 years ago to today, for the good, the bad, the in-between, or how do you see things happening today?
Yeah, I did. I was probably honest, like to a fault. You know, so it's easy to be critical online and then, you know, you go to an event and you realize like that's a real human being, you know, behind that screen name. And, you know, I said they were terrible, or, you know, and that's being gentle. Like that would be a nice thing I would say. And so, yeah, I regret some of that, but then, you know, some of it is also true in that, you know, the MMA media was definitely deserved a lot of the criticism it took from hardcore fans. And I, you know, the problems were kind of twofold. One, that they were very carefully controlled by the promoters that they basically worked for almost to, you know, because they were dependent on them for access and for credentials and to get interviews and just, you know, to have a decent camaraderie when they went to events. You know, there was a lot of pressure on them to kind of take it easy on promoters. And so, you know, I definitely saw that and that was worthy of criticism. And then the other thing was what we talked about earlier is that, they just didn't know that much about the history of mixed martial arts. And sometimes that's, you know, that's kind of irksome, especially like, you know, there's kind of a tendency in the media to do a lot of like hyperbole, like this was the greatest knockout, the greatest submission, the greatest fight, the first time this has ever happened. And, you know, on and on. And when your like breadth of knowledge sometimes doesn't warrant you making those claims. Like if you've only been watching or reporting on something for like a year or two, you're probably not the right person to say what's historically the greatest fight of all time. You just don't know. Like you haven't experienced enough to have like a valid opinion in that area. And that's not something that comes intuitively to a lot of people in the media who value their own opinion very highly, whether or not it's well-educated. And so, I think those two things were at the heart of my criticisms. And to be fair, it's easier for me to be critical of promoters and to say what I think because this has never been my job. Like this has never been what I do for a living. It's turned into a very lucrative hobby. But, you know, it's okay that I'm banned by the UFC. because, you know, if this all went away tomorrow, I would be okay. And so it's easy to be brave when your risk is much lower. So I do recognize that, you know, that it's easy for me to be critical of someone who needs this to feed their family when I'm kind of, you know, a little bit removed from those kind of pressures. So in some ways that's, it makes it easier for me. And then maybe that means that I have a responsibility then to say these things because I can get away with it. Mm-hmm. And so I've taken on that role, or at least I used to probably do it much less now, but it was, I think maybe there, it was kind of important that there was someone like me to try to keep people honest. And I've got some regrets, but not entirely. You know, I don't regret everything.
I would agree with that. I remember just kind of thinking through. I remember one tweet specifically because you brought up something that is, I don't know really what the context was, but it was really truthful. It was good to hear someone say that because it was about basically how most of the MMA media are part time, and that there's not a lot of full time people that are doing this, and it's just it. It made me think because, like, very similar to you, like, I have a full-time job. This is something I do on the side for fun and also money as well, but that, you know, I like doing it. But there's so many people that are just – they're doing this part-time and they're just not making a lot of money and all this stuff. And it's crazy because you try to think of, like, compared to other sports and how are the sports are treated. There's all kinds of people, I guess, doing this part-time with different blogs and different, you know, smaller websites and things like that. But this is – it's a very unique space where people just – end up becoming like MMA media people, but they don't really have any formal training. Don't know a lot of sports history. They just kind of arrive here and some of these people are also driving conversation somehow because they have a shit ton of Twitter followers or, you know, they happen to hook up with a specific site or something like that. The makeup of kind of how our media is it's very strange. And I think it kind of falls to sport itself where it's, you mentioned like the levels of access. I mean, if you're covering a traditional sport, quote unquote, that, you know, there's PR people and you have a specific outlet, you get credentialed, you have access to certain places, you know, certain players and all that. But MMA is just it's really like still the wild, wild west and how it's like conducted and depending on the level of promotion you're dealing with and all that stuff. So, yeah, it's I remember that standing out and just kind of like how the makeup of the media is just so like it's very unique, I guess to say.
Yeah, so some of that was kind of like a warning because, you know, like most people, like have some sort of minor name in mixed martial arts media. You know, I get a lot of people saying, "How do I break into this? How do I do it? What can you help me?" And in some ways, I just wanted to be honest in a way that people aren't normally honest. That like that this may not be something that you want to count on doing for a living.
Yeah,
because you know, there's probably 20 people that make more than $30,000 a year or something writing about mixed martial arts in the entire world. So it's like, in some ways, and people went crazy when I said this, but in some ways it's much harder to break into the MMA media, than it is to break into the UFC. There are fewer successful MMA reporters than there are MMA fighters. And, and the barrier to entry I think is higher at this point to be a successful MMA writer. And so it's, I get nervous when I see kids, but the people that I consider kids, you know, in their early 20s, wanting to do this for a living. And it's like, man, no, go get a job and then do this for fun. And if it works out, great. And if not, you have a job, you know, because the likelihood of being successful is really low. And a lot of it just happens is because you're in the right place at the right time. And it's has not necessarily that much to do with merit or anything else. It's just like the luck of the draw and some work ethic and a little bit of talent, but you know, there's no guarantees and you can't work your way into it. You can't be great. You can't grate your way into it. A lot of it just has to, fall into place for you. And what are the chances that's going to happen?
Yep. I would agree. Before we get to the Shamrock book, I want to ask you about the state of MMA in general, because obviously you've been following this for a long time and obviously, you know, dating back to Japan and just early UFC and what have you. And then you had to have, you know, the UFC hitting its 25th anniversary in the last week. What you know, what's your feeling on kind of the state of the sport and just where it's at, and I guess just from a a culture standpoint, where the sport is? Do you think it's healthy? Just your overall, just honest thoughts on where MMA is in 2018.
Yeah. So it's really kind of confusing to the, it's a deep question in some ways, because what I know intellectually, when you look at the success the UFC has had and the fact that it's a $1 billion industry and they just sold their television rights to ESPN for, you know, a huge sum of money. And we're finding out that they're getting a bigger percentage of their pay-per-view income, up to 70% starting next year, when typically it's split 50-50 with cable companies. And so, when you look at it that way, obviously the UFC and by proxy MMA generally, because the two are still so associated that, you know, you can't really separate them. The UFC is very successful, and you can't really deny that. At the same time, like, emotionally and in my interest level is really low, and it feels like something that's struggling, and that they're having a hard time finding their way, and they're putting on a lot of listless cards and they're having a hard time creating these kind of transcendent superstars. And, you know, you worry about the future of the business in that way. That's my emotional feeling. That's my personal feeling. But at the same time, you can't deny intellectually that they're very successful. So I'm worried about them, but maybe needlessly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think with both UFC and WWE, and I saw you were tweeting earlier about the Becky Lynch and Ronda storyline, which seems to be, you know, capturing a lot of interest and so on. But it's kind of like, I don't want, you know, you don't want to have to deal with the slog of having to get there, you know, and deal with WWE TV week in and week out. And I think that the content era that we're in, and just fill hours and fill time and all, I think it's so damaging for trying to bring in new fans and trying to keep people engaged. And I have so many friends, I'm sure you do too, that used to watch MMA, UFC back in the post-Tough boom era. And they just kind of just faded out over time, because they're like, I can't keep up. And they want to be able to keep up, but they just can't. And I think it's, you know, obviously the money is there. WWE's making a ton of money, this new deal. UFC's making a ton of money. Bellator, for Christ's sakes, just got all this money from DAZN, right? And it's just like, you know, there's all this money out there. And there's just so much MMA that just doesn't seem to matter. It's just there because it has to fill time. The way they present the shows now, where it's like one fight every half an hour, and you have to wait until 1:30 in the morning if you want to see a main event on East Coast time. It's just so backward thinking from like what a good tight product could be. But no one seems to care because everyone's making money. And just, I just wonder where we're going to be, you know, 10, 15 years from now, as far as any of the stuff, you know. It's crazy to think that the sport has more money in it these days, but sometimes it just feels less and less interesting. And a lot of times you have to fight your way through to get to the really good stuff, you know?
Well, with WWE, for a while I was writing about it every week for Bleacher Report. I was doing interviews with the quote unquote superstars, and I was covering every Raw and every pay-per-view. And, that got to be a little exhausting. And, since they kind of went in another direction, I've quit watching WWE television altogether. And then I will occasionally tune into one of the big pay-per-views, or if there's a match I hear about that interests me, I'll watch. But, you know, I don't consume 98% of it. And I found that you don't miss it at all, and nor do you need it. That's the thing, is like, I see all these people that drive themselves crazy watching Raw and SmackDown every week and complaining about it. And you just don't need to. It's like, you know, if you've been a wrestling fan for more than a couple of years, like, you don't really need that much backstory. Like, you can understand based on their video package the story that they're telling. They do a real good job of summarizing it before every pay-per-view. And so I found, like, why bother spending 5 or 6 hours a week watching something that kind of slowly drives you insane when, you know, you can just tune in for the big matches and kind of, you see the good promos and you see the spots on, if you're on Twitter, and you see the GIFs and stuff, like, that's enough for me. And then, you know, I just tune into the parts where they're putting their best foot forward, and I really enjoy it a lot more that way, because no matter how positive you are as a person and as a wrestling fan, I'm super positive. I love watching wrestling from all over the world. But no matter how much you want to love wrestling, WWE makes it really hard. If you consume all their product, you will hate it. No matter who you are, eventually you will hate it. It will drive you crazy. And so a way around that is to just kind of skip out all those parts that are going to bug you and just watch the cool parts with the big matches where everybody's working really hard. And they're trying their best to make it a coherent storyline from whatever they've done in the past 4 weeks. And that's enough. I advocate that so much to people because it's really changed my relationship with WWE from one where I was growing to kind of hate it to where I can tune in and enjoy it every once in a while. And that's fun.
What wrestling has captured your interest most these days? What are you most interested in watching?
So my wife has gotten super into New Japan Pro Wrestling. And so so we watched that. I mean, she had watched some of it. Like we rediscovered wrestling together in college. I think it's my junior year of college. We were coming home one night. It was like midnight or 2 a.m. or something, and we found ECW. It was just on TV, like one of these off-brand channels, and that was the first time I had probably watched wrestling since I was a young teenager. And so, you know, we started a wrestling journey together, but she's rediscovered it with New Japan and she loves Kenny Omega and loves Okada and these guys. So we watch all the New Japan, like I'm talking about even the ones that they shoot with like the one camera on the house show.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Like we're watching all of it, like even the worst stuff. And so really into that. I've rediscovered Ring of Honor. We have the High Spots Network and we're watching stuff like AEW and Pro Wrestling Guerrilla and a lot of stuff that I've missed over the years. Like I'm learning to love now. And it's been fun. It's been the, you know, we've been doing this for maybe 6 months or so, and it's still, everything still feels fresh. And, so it's, to me, it feels like a really good time to be a wrestling fan. And that's the one benefit. Like we were talking about some of the negatives about the huge number of things that are available and how hard it is to kind of discover things. And, the fact that it's all there is good sometimes. Like when you really get into it, like we have, like there's no shortage of good things that we want to watch. And so that's part of the reason too, where it's like, why would I watch something that I don't love? Cause I know there's other stuff out there that I am going to love and it's readily available with one or two clicks. And so it really is in that way a great time to be a wrestling fan.
I know. Every time I think about complaining, I think of like 12-year-old me would come and kick my ass. Cause if I had like, you know, you had to like fight for tapes and we just talked about you go to the video store and like, there'd be like 3 Coliseum videotapes. It'd be like the same ones over and over and over again. You watch and now it's like, I can see anything I want in like, 2 clicks. It just, it's amazing. Amazing stuff.
Yeah, but we still complain about it because we're human beings,
that's
right?
True.
And that's how we're wired.
Wrestling fans are wired to complain. There's no doubt about that. sure. So let's get to the Shamrock book. So I had obviously you've been known, you've been working on this for a while, but then I saw the Indiegogo come up the other day and you can find it. I would read off the URL, but it's easier to go to Jonathan Snowden's Twitter account. It's pinned right at the top there. And you can see that. And as of right now, it's about $5,800, about the raised for the $10,000 goal with about just under 3 weeks left. Ton of different options here. So let's talk about the book. So what, obviously you've had the history of writing books and we've kind of established that. So why Ken Shamrock and why now?
Yeah, I mean, so that's really the big question. And I had told myself I wasn't going to write another book. I had 2 more books, I think, under contract with ECW Press, and I just didn't want to do it. You know, the financial reward wasn't really there, and it's a lot of effort to do it the right way. And so I had kind of thought I was out of the business of writing books, and then this kind of opportunity fell in my lap and, you know, I decided it was too good to pass up. So what happened was, I think 2015, maybe it was, I went to San Diego to do a story on Ken for Bleacher Report. He was going to fight Kimbo Slice. This is the time he actually fought Kimbo Slice, not the time where he cut his, cut his head and and put a promotion out of business and didn't fight Kimbo Slice. The time he actually fought Kimbo Slice.
Yeah.
I went out and did a profile of him for Bleacher Report, and it ended up being one of the most successful profiles we had ever done as far as, like, you know, the response it got and how many people read it. So it was a pretty big deal. And one thing I really remember is, like, you know, I'm sitting around talking to Ken, and I'm asking him about the old days. And he goes, you know a lot more about my career than I do. And that must have stuck with him, because a couple of years later, his manager came to me and said, Ken's interested in writing a book and he wants you to write it. And, you know, at first I said no, because I didn't want to do one of these kind of Chuck Liddell, Tito Ortiz, Randy Couture kind of glossy autobiography where they leave out all the interesting parts and all the bad parts. And it's only just like, hey, and then in 2003, I had a fight with this guy and I won. And then in 2004, there was another fight and, you know, I lost. And here's because of this reason, you know, I didn't want to do that. I had no interest in it. That seemed like it would drive me crazy. And there was not really any need for it. Right. I mean, Ken's already had two books in that style. And, but I made them a counter proposal, which is, how about you allow me to write a real biography? You give me all access. You help me get in touch with the people in your life from your childhood to now, and kind of like give them your blessing to talk to me. And then allow me to have complete editorial control and write a book about your life. You know, you trust me with your story. And, he said yes. I was kind of amazed. I thought I didn't imagine they'd say yes. And we kind of took off from there. And, the stuff he told me just amazed me. You know, the first night we talked for an hour and a half on the phone, and we talked for 2 hours the next night. And it's like, he'd been holding in all this stuff, like, for so long. He'd been, you know, like most athletes, he was trying to put this public face out in front to the world. And there's a lot of pressure involved with that. And finally it was like, he was letting go of some of this stuff. And, and it only got more interesting from there. You know, yeah. I thought I knew a lot about Ken Shamrock, having written about him in Total MMA and the MMA Encyclopedia. Then there's a whole kind of section on him and shooters, him and the Pankhurst Revolution. And, but I didn't know anything. Like, I had no idea. And I think people are going to be, very interested in some of the stuff that comes out of this.
So, without, you know, spoiling anything, obviously, is there one story that sticks out? Maybe an early one you heard, you were just like, wow, this is going to be quite a ride.
Some of the extent of, like, his sexual conquests, cause he was a married man through much of his fighting prime and celebrity, like, the amount of debauchery that is involved with a famous wrestler or fighter is, at least if you're Ken Shamrock, is pretty amazing. And I ended up hearing probably more than I was comfortable about his life in that area and some of the things he got into and how other wrestlers got involved. And I'm going to have to work really hard not to make this an X-rated book. And so, and there's just stuff like that. Like, you know, I don't think, you know, cause Ken is always presented as almost like this all American figure, right? He's a baby face. At least he was until that Ultimate Fighter where they turned him heel, like, I guess, or he turned himself depending on how you look at it. But, you know, there was a kind of a darkness to Ken too. And we really go into that. And, I was surprised at the extent of it, of the darkness and the fighting and the drugs and stuff I wasn't aware of. And I think, it'll give people a new way to look at Ken and his life and help explain some of the things that happened to him later in his career.
Are all the interviews done at this point?
Well, I keep saying that they are, and then people keep coming forward. And so, and that's the thing is, once you start in a project like this, you know, I've probably done close to 100 interviews now. And then, you know, you have a successful interview with somebody and you've probably had this experience too. And then they introduce you to somebody, hey, this guy knew Ken as well. And we did this together. And all of a sudden, you've got another interview and then another, and then it just keeps steamrolling. So at some point for my own sanity, I guess I'm going to have to make a hard cut and say no more after this. But then at the same time, like if his ex-wife were to call, I want to talk. I'm not going to say no to that either. So it may be a thing that we're working on it like right up until the minute we press go. I hate to think about that, but that may be the truth.
So you're looking to deliver this in August 2019, it seems?
Yes. And okay. So that's, you know, I've always just been the writer on books and, you know, and then the publisher does all of the actual work of putting it together, right? I just put some words on a document and they made it into a book. And now I've taken on another challenge and that's the production of the book and figuring out that end of it. And so I just wanted to make sure there was plenty of time, to deliver a quality product and give myself a chance to make sure I get it right. And so that's part of that, the reason I've set that date. And that's, to me, that's a worst case scenario. There's an off chance that maybe we do it a little earlier than that, you know, we'll just see, but that'll be like the last possible moment it will be delivered to people is August, 2019.
Got it. So the book will, so regardless of whether or not you raise the money, which obviously we assume you will, but if regardless or not that this book is definitely happening, or is it really dependent on that?
No, I'm going to do this one way or the other.
Yeah.
I've already decided. I probably shouldn't say that because now people are less likely to give their money. But I'm going to do this. I think I owe it to Ken and to everyone I've talked to and to really to just MMA to have this book out there. Like it's, this is like the, if I was a baseball writer and, you know, Babe Ruth is out there and I was just like, yeah, I don't really want to talk to Babe Ruth. Who cares?
Yeah.
You know, these figures are still alive in our sport. I mean, Ken Shamrock was the, in the very first Pancras event, the very first UFC event, champion of both promotions. He's one of the guys that literally created this thing that we all enjoy. And so the fact that he's been willing to tell his real story and to explain what it was really like to be in there and to have the people around him explain, like, this is how Ken prepared himself. You know, these were the drugs that we used. This is what it was like to train with him. This is what it was like to go out and party with him. This was our experience. This was the money we made. This is why we moved to WWE. Here's why we came back. Like all these things, like the story deserves to be told. And I think it's important that we tell these stories while these guys are still here to share them with us. And so, you know, it'd be a huge disservice for me to say like, you know, I only raised $8,000 instead of $10,000. I'm not going to do this.
Right.
There's no chance. I'm going to do this book is getting done. It would have been done if it was only for me and Ken.
Yeah.
But hopefully there's more people than that interested. So
kind of like that, that Wu-Tang album that only one person has heard, Martin Shkreli or whatever the pharma, right. Pharma dude is.
It's
right?
Actually kind of like the opposite of that. Like, so if that guy came to me and said, you know, I will give you the whole $10,000, but you just give me the book or whatever. I'd say no. Cause I, you know, the idea is to share this story with people and fans and let them understand what it was like, because I think it was a very different time. And Ken is one of those guys that kind of bridges the gap between those early years where he started the sport, but he's also a pivotal figure as it grew, right? In those early Ultimate Fighter years and his fight with Tito Ortiz that at UFC 40 that kind of saved the company and was the first glimpse that Lorenzo Fertitta had that this could be a money-making venture. And then he came back for the Ultimate Fighter and it was a huge success. And then he helped launch Bellator in a big way and had some of their big successful events. Like, you know, Ken's been important, you know, no matter what people think about his most recent fights and the fact that, you know, as an older fighter, he lost more than he won. The fact is that, you know, a lot of people are in this business. This business even exists today because of the things that he did. So it's definitely an important story to tell, I think.
And you have a ton of different levels in which people can support and get a copy of the book. Everything from a almost a traditional ebook. That's 2018 traditional ebook. An ebook for just $7. I mean, how can people not do that if they're interested at all in this topic? But you have, you know, paperback books, illustrated hardcovers as well. For those international listeners, you can get stuff there as well. Autographed paperbacks. You have an action. I was looking at some of these action figure bundles, Japanese magazine bundles. And even you can attend, if people have the deep pockets, they can attend an MMA event with Ken and get an exclusive paying as well for up to $1,500. So yeah, you have a lot of for a guy that has not done this before, you have a swath of different options in which people can contribute.
Yeah, so we studied it, and my friend Brian Oswald, who was the MMA editor at Bleacher Report, kind of looked into it for me and kind of helped me come up with some of these ideas. And then also it was Ken's idea as well to have someone come and sit with him at an event. And, you know, I understand it's expensive, but, you know, Ken is a really entertaining guy. And I think people would enjoy that. Like, it's a once in a lifetime kind of opportunity. Like, a lot of people will go out to Las Vegas or something and go see a UFC, and that'll be like kind of a big deal for them, and they'll go back and tell all their buddies at the bar, like, yeah, I went to the UFC and we sat cage side and, you know, Dana shook my hand and stuff. Like, but just the opportunity to sit with Ken and listen to his stories, and it's interesting to sit with a fighter or a coach as they watch the fights. You always see it from a different perspective then. And I think that's interesting as well. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, if there's somebody out there listening that has a lot of money and wants to take that on, but you know, there's also the, you know, slightly less expensive, like the Japanese magazine bundle was interesting. You know, Ken had this collection of magazines that basically are magazines from Japan from like 93 to 97. I think it's the latest one that had him on the cover. And he was willing to let those go. So these are one of a kind items. You know, mm-hmm. there are no more Japanese magazines unless he finds some more in the attic or something that belong to Ken Shamrock with him on the cover and his signature on them. So this is these are it. And there's one of those left. And so, I tried to get creative with it and have fun, and maybe we'll add some more. We're looking into doing a t-shirt with the book's cover on it and stuff like that. So the last couple of weeks, maybe we'll give people some new options, but I didn't want to just throw a book out there. Like, you know, let's make it interesting and give people something that they can't get anywhere else.
Yep. Well, I mean, a lot of different options again, plenty of time to donate money, but to contribute money to this effort and get something back. So that's a nice perk as well. And definitely looking forward to it. So before we let you go, you've been very generous with your time. Give you the chance to, do your Mean Gene Okerlund or your Paul Heyman and promote a little bit. Obviously we talked about the Shamrock book, but, you're doing some other work for Bleacher Report and obviously the books we talked about and everything else, but, you know, throw you the microphone, the floor is yours, wherever you want to tell people about, including if there may be some older, profiles and features that you've done for Bleacher Report that people should check out.
Yeah. So one of the things I didn't mention and that's kind of important, and part of the reason that we're attempting to raise this money, this $10,000, it doesn't quite cost that much to put this book together. Part of it is that we've started this company called Hybrid Shoot, which is going to be a publishing company that is for hardcore fans by hardcore fans. So it's kind of the same idea that launched Total MMA. I want to help do that for other writers, especially younger writers and especially writers and artists who are really into the niche stuff. Like, you know, there's always going to be the possibility of a book about Ronda Rousey or Conor McGregor. Those are the kind of things that are going to pop up, and a mainstream New York publisher is going to take those on, and you're going to see them in Barnes and Noble. But I think there's like an appetite among wrestling and MMA fans for long form quality content about really niche subjects. Like, maybe there's a book about Mid-South wrestling, or there's a book about the history of FMW, or we do a book about Shudo. Really small, but, you know, for a very passionate audience. And that's part of what this $10,000 is going to go towards. It will allow us to help fund not just the Ken Shamrock book, but the book after that and the book after that. You know, we're looking to get several books out there and help launch some new careers and some new people in the combat sports space, and to allow people who are out there, like you're talking about, bloggers and really talented people who aren't able to make a living, make a few extra dollars and share their great talent with the world. And so that's really the other part of what we're raising this money for, is to launch other people and other books and really allow them to get creative and to get real specific and not worry about, is there a big, broad mainstream audience for this? I don't care. I want to make books for people like me and people like you who are interested in the really the minutia of it and the smaller promotions and the smaller stories. We want to do that kind of work. And so that's part of what this $10,000 is for. And so I hope people will contribute. Not, it won't just benefit me and Ken, but it'll benefit some of the other people that we're talking with and help us put some other cool things out there into the world. And I think that's something worthwhile. Mm. And so that's probably more of a pitch than you want. And so also there's stories at Bleacher Report that you can click on. most recently, a story about the history of UFC 1 that I wrote. That was earlier this week. The 25th anniversary came up, and I was able to talk to Ken and the Gracies and the people from SCG, which was the pay-per-view company that took on the UFC financially and allowed them to put their show on and then promoted the event right up through the Fertittas buying it. So that was cool. And that's up on Bleacher Report right now.
Excellent. Yeah, no, I was, I had no idea that was going to be kind of the plan going forward for Hybrid Shoot. And yeah, I think it's a great idea, especially in today's, media world. Everything is about like, just give me stuff that I'm interested in. And when you talk about how people's worldviews kind of get skewed by that. But as far as like, the fun stuff people are interested in, like they want to be able to get books about Ken Shamrock specifically, or they want to be able to these specific topics that are really important to a you mentioned like niche groups. I mean, that stuff, it matters because there's plenty of people out there who that's what they want and that's all they want to read about and consume. And I mean, you might as well serve it up to them, right?
I hope so. And more than that, like, I just want these stories to be told as well. Like, they're great stories and they're people that deserve to be remembered. So, not only am I looking to put these books out and help people make a little bit of money, but I want to help preserve the history of these things, because it's real easy. You can see it happen, especially with two dominant promotions in both wrestling and MMA, with UFC and WWE. They are constantly in the process of rewriting their history, and people come in and fall out based on, whether they're in favor or not with the group. And the story kind of shifts subtly over time, so it's more favorable to the ownership, and they erase some of the mistakes they've made, and they kind of artificially inflate some of the good things that happened. And we need an honest history of these things, and I think we can help do that. And so my goal is to find the people who were like me in 2005 and really into it and really interested in the topic, and have them do the story. Like, I don't want it to just be me. I wouldn't want to take on a book about like Lucha Libre wrestling or All Japan women's wrestling. I don't know enough about it. I'm not passionate enough about it, but I'll bet there are people who are, and I want to help them put that out into the world. That's really my goal.
And a final prediction, I'll give you this: by 2020, I'll say by the summer of 2020, assuming you hit all your deadlines, which I'm sure you will, you will be telling us about how Shamrock has been optioned for a series at Netflix.
Well,
how's that for a prediction?
I think he would be thrilled by that. And the problem with Ken's story, in as far as that goes, is that it's almost – people will not believe it. It's stranger than fiction. And people would say, like, there's just no way that's true.
Yeah.
Like, his story is that wild. Like, he has lived so many different lives and so many things. Like, the fact that Ken Shamrock is even alive at this moment is like a minor miracle of some sort. So that would be great. If we could make that happen, I think he's definitely worthy of it, right? How many great boxing movies have there been over the years? And MMA hasn't really filled that space yet. But maybe with guys like Ken, it can. That would be wonderful.
Now we got to work on the casting of that. And who would you cast for Ken Shamrock? I can't even picture at this point.
I mean, whoever it is, they better start lifting right now. That's all I know.
yeah.
Maybe. You should see. I'm watching the old WWF of Ken, and normal humans don't look like that. So yeah, they better get in the gym right now if they want to play Ken Shamrock.
That's right. Yeah, maybe Lou Ferrigno has a son out there somewhere that can do it. You know.
That would be cool. Ken's got some sons, but none of them look like Ken. So they don't have Ken's. They didn't inherit those muscles. So it's going to have to be somebody else.
Well, best of luck to you. I will say, you know, CM Punk says luck is for losers, but I think this is going to be great. I'm really looking forward to reading it and hearing about the path to get there, and always fascinated by kind of this new media era that we're in and how people are to fund their dreams and give people some good stuff to read too. So again, support the effort, and Jonathan Snowden, thanks so much for stopping by, and best of luck, man. I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens with this next.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
All right. Big thanks to Jonathan Stone for spending an hour with us, you and I, dear listener. You can obviously follow him on Twitter, J.E. Snowden, S-N-O-W-D-E-N, on Twitter, pinned at the top, a link to the Indiegogo page. I sound like I'm 60. It's linked to the, there's the link there. You can actually contribute, do the pre-order for the book, contribute to the effort and all that good stuff as well. Okay. I'm going to talk like I'm 40 again. So yeah, that was a fun conversation. I hope you guys really enjoyed that. And I'm looking forward to that book. It should be a lot of fun. And obviously we've got a long time between now and then. So maybe we'll talk about the book, later on when it comes out and kind of the process and all that good stuff as well. And, yeah, really looking forward to checking out the book in the summer of 2019, which is crazy to think about at this point in November 2018. And no UFC Argentina preview. Sorry, everyone. Not that excited about this card. I am interested in my next town over neighbor, Devin Powell, fighting on the undercard. He had the testicular surgery earlier this year. Came back, big fight, got some headlines for basically saying that he wasn't able to fix his stove and that the UFC win bonus was going to help him be able to do that, which is a very sad story indeed. But Devin Powell competing on the undercard, so I'm interested in that. Other than that, not a lot of other interest in the show, unfortunately. Obviously, the UFC 25th anniversary show came and went, and some good stuff. The Cerrone and Perry fight, It was fun. Actually, it wasn't even really that fun. It was just kind of like, it felt one-sided in a way. It just wasn't that exciting. Sometimes with these fan service fights, you get that. I keep thinking like Derek Lewis, Francis Ngannou, and people were really excited about that. That didn't really turn out to be much. Obviously, it was one of the worst fights of the year. And Cerrone Perry was not that, but it just didn't really do that much for me. I was kind of looking forward to more of a firefight that I think like a lot of other people. Just didn't merely materialize, but obviously the main event more than made up for it with Korean Zombie and Yair Rodriguez. And I didn't really mention during the interview with John, I kind of wanted to bring it up, is recency bias and everyone saying, this is the best fight ever, this is the best knockout ever, and so on and so forth. So obviously that knockout was ridiculous. The fight itself was great. Definitely, I'd say for sure, top 10. Fight of the year candidate. The best fight of the year? I don't know that. I try to stay away from that hyperbole and like immediately be like, oh, this is the best thing ever, even though it's kind of like your emotions at the time. So I like to kind of like sit back, think about things. There's so many fights that we've seen, you and I, throughout the years and throughout this year especially, that, let's see kind of where things fit. But if top 10 one, I'd say for sure. Maybe even top 5. So we'll obviously we'll talk about that here in the next couple months as we kick in the year in review shows. And other than that, UFC Argentina coming this week, Ponzinibbio versus Magny as a main event. It is a fight. It is a main event. And it is the content glut we're in that there's a UFC show every single weekend. So somebody's got a main event, right? Especially when they debut in a country like Argentina. They're really setting the stars down there for the show this weekend. So let's get out of here. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks so much to John Stone for hanging out for an hour. Look forward to having him on again soon. Support the book and let him know if you heard him on the show and that, let him know that you're supporting the book. if you did so because you heard the show. I greatly appreciate that as well. As always, you have a lot of choices in your podcast day, so I appreciate you spending any time with me or anyone else on WrestlingObserver.com. Thank you very much. So I'm Josh Nason. This has been Josh Nason's Punch Out, and until next time, insert catchphrase here.